Okay, this is the last opportunity for questions. And if after this evening's questions, you still have some more questions, there's still a chance by coming to the next retreat. It's a hard bad enough of questions. Okay, but first of all, in the interview time, so some people were asking about some of the things I said in the talk this morning about compassion. I was focusing especially on the talk about the best compassion of all, the pure compassion, the ultimate compassion, which is always with lots and lots of wisdom. So when you've got perfect wisdom, then you have perfect compassion. So that means the arahat, fully enlightened one. But you don't have to wait until you've got perfect compassion to do little acts of compassion. So please, all the time, be kind to each other. And be kind to oneself. And be kind to others. Be kind to everybody. And that's acts of compassion. Really, the point of that part of the talk this morning was just to say, be careful of compassion. Don't just be compassionate without saying, what am I doing? And why am I doing it? And is what I'm going to do, is it going to be conducive to the goal? In other words, is it going to fulfill my purpose? Is it really going to help and create extra happiness in the world? Or is it going to create more difficulty and suffering? And there's one little story which came to mind. I told a few people during the interviews. You know that we go on pilgrimages in India. And there was one occasion when we went over there. And just on the first day in the bus, we were told, and told quite rightly, if you see any beggars there, please don't give them anything yourselves. We'll organise some way of giving to the poor people, but don't just give things straight away. And there was one, it was a Sri Lankan lady, she was very stubborn, and the first place we stopped, when there was a little beggar, a very poor little girl there, was begging, and she threw out some sort of jacket or some shirt at the girl, just, you know, to give her something. And it was the most stupid thing she could have possibly done, because it was done out of compassion, but no wisdom at all. Because as soon as that girl received that cloth, she was pounced on by all the other beggars. The cloth was ripped to shreds, and she got a beating for her trouble, pummeled and thumped by the other beggars. And so the effect of that was she got just a tiny piece of cloth, maybe about this big, and lots of bruises, and lots of tears afterwards. That was not the way to give. It was compassion, yeah, but it ended up creating a lot of problems for that poor girl. So I mention that because that's another example there. That be compassionate, yeah, but be wise with your compassion. Otherwise, you think you're giving help to other people, but sometimes just give them a beating. So that's the meaning of the talk. But be compassionate. Don't stop being compassionate. But be wise and compassionate as well. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah, now the first question today. Look how, if I've got my glasses on, I should be compassionate to my eyes. I can see what's going on. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, I have found a skillful means that I would like to share. Is there any sort of, what's it called, royalties on your skillful means? It's all right that we can share them out with me. I call it the broken car technique. Okay, this is interesting. I haven't heard this one before. Often, when you have a car for a long time, if there's a small problem that develops, you will notice it. Then you'll bring it in to the mechanic. And, of course, he'll say, sorry, I couldn't find anything wrong, but that'll be $150, please. But if you want, the problem becomes less subtle as time and your use of the car continue. Then when the problem is really apparent and the car is nearly shaking apart, the mechanic can see the problem signs and diagnose and repair the car. That probably cost $1,500. I have found that a similar technique works with my mind. If I meditate and there's an obstruction that I can't identify, I mentally amplify it until my mind is nearly shaking apart. Then I can much more easily see, oh, the problem is related to doubt or whatever hindrance it is. As soon as I recognize the cause, blammo, That's a very nice word, blammo. That's a good word, I like blammo. Blammo, the problem subsides, and I save myself $150. Okay, it's just like they're saying, when you've got problems in your meditation, just keep on continuing. You can amplify it until it gets so bad. Your mind is really falling apart. I don't know if I agree with that one. But if it works, then go for it. So, but be very careful if your mind gets really, really tense and really, really falling apart. Because other people, they have to look after you afterwards. And that's not really good. And I lose my reputation of being a good meditation teacher. Yeah. So the point is that you don't really have to amplify the problem, but amplify your mindfulness. And that's much better. So in other words, if you see there's a problem there, so get out the magnifying glass, or get out a brighter torch, or a flashlight, so you can actually see more clearly. I mean, that's the best way of finding the problem. So don't go beating around to try and fix up the problem. I know that that's why some people actually fix their computers, give them a kit, it's called booting the computers. If that doesn't work, you reboot it. But that's actually, that used to actually work sometimes with these old televisions you used to have when I was a kid. I forget what they had. Remember those old televisions? You used to bag it, you used to start working again. It's amazing. But you can't do that with modern technology. And you can't do that with the modern technology which is your mind. You can't give it a kick and hopefully it will start again. So you've got to be very subtle and very mindful. So you look and see what's going on there. Why? What's happening? So with that sort of watching, and again, amplification is actually when the mind becomes very subtle. And if you just stay there and watch, don't try and do anything, get all the data, and then you might find what's going on. But in particular, one of the great skillful means, which I mentioned but I haven't emphasized, is that at the end of every meditation, you look back and see, what have I done, what's happened, why has it happened? And find out this cause and effect relationship. If you have a peaceful meditation, why? If it's not so peaceful, why? Find out what goes on. And then you get skillful in meditation. You understand what the triggers are of restlessness, or the triggers of sleepiness, or the triggers of peace, or the triggers of bliss are. Once you know all those triggers, when you know what all the causes are, you can always remember the causes, and you put those causes in place, and then you get all those beautiful states again. You take away the causes of what you call unsuccessful meditation, and then you find sort of you never have to waste time so much anymore. So learn from your successes, learn from the mistakes, and that way you become a very skillful meditator. By the end of every meditation, reflecting back on what you did and why. Okay. The next question, dear Ajahn. Sometimes people appear unexpectedly in dreams. That's really rude, isn't it? They should at least sort of ring you up and tell you they're coming or something. Sometimes people appear unexpectedly in dreams, so it doesn't feel as if you've been thinking about them subconsciously. Is it because they're thinking about you strongly, or is it just only your own mind? Yeah, sometimes people appear in your dreams. And sometimes it is because they're thinking, somebody actually said that. I think you were saying earlier that, no, not dreams, we're thinking about them and they thought of you, or they can sometimes dream about you. So, if you've been thinking about them. So, understanding how you can influence other people in their dreams by focusing your mind when you're very, very peaceful, you've got lots of mindfulness. Imagine what you can do to your ex-husband. You can actually give him a lecture in his dream. Imagine what you could do to your ex-wife. You tell her off. But don't do it that way. Always be kind. You know, if you get ill will and you try to do things like that, you don't have the power, you lose all the power. That's why you can spread loving kindness. You can think of someone and wish them well. But do you think you can try and do the opposite? Wish somebody bad? You've got your enemy, so you concentrate your mind. At the end of the retreat, you've got this very, very powerful mind. And you think of that person, there you'd be sick. You can't do that because of ill will. That sort of takes away the power of the mind. Loving kindness increases the power. That's actually a very nice thing. That if they appear in your dream and they be thinking about you, can only be nice thoughts. That's why they come in your dream. They're thinking of what thoughts they can't come in. Isn't that nice? So the only people who think about are people who are thinking nice things about you. And that actually one of those stories which I tell. This was actually just shows about wisdom and just how when you're very still and peaceful, it's amazing just what wisdom you can get. It was a true story which happened in the court of the King of Thailand many, many, many years ago. In those days, in the court, they'd have their ministers, the wise people. They have a few like smart alecks. And they were very, very sharp, very witty. And, the king liked a bit of entertainment, in his court. So they had one of these guys, incredibly intelligent, really, really sharp. But everyone was just so jealous of this guy. He was basically one of these know-it-alls. And, the king liked him. But all the other people in the court, they hated his guts. So they decided they ganged up on him. They had this plan. Because he was smart, he was wise, he was also a little bit too proud. So then what they were going to do, they were going to praise him in front of the king. Oh, how wonderful this fellow is. Oh, how great he is. He's probably so smart. He probably already knows what we're all thinking. And they thought he may take the bait and say, yeah, I know what you're all thinking. And then we'll have him. Because even if he reads our mind, he's got it right, we'd always say, no, he's wrong. Because who can prove what you're thinking? So they'd always say it's wrong, just to embarrass him. So that was their plan. Apparently this is a true story. And so, the following day, in the court, when it came to the right time, one of the courtiers said, oh, isn't it wonderful, you've got this fellow in your court. He's so wise, he's so clever, he's so learning. He's probably so amazing that he probably knows what we're all thinking. Do you know what we're all thinking? They said to this man, he said, yeah, sure. And they thought, aha, we've got him, we've caught him. Because if he gets it wrong, it shows that he's overestimating himself. And he has to get it wrong, because whatever he says, we'll say the opposite. And so he said, okay, what are we all thinking? And this minister said, you are all thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And they thought for a while, we better not negate that. Yes, you're right. Very, very sharp, true story. That guy was really, really wise. He was almost in the spot and he got himself out. So, if you've been thinking about somebody, he may appear in their dreams. But sometimes it might be just the way that actually dreams work, or even like memories work, sometimes it's just a trigger, which triggers off that memory. We may have just, even in a dream, be thinking about some event or something, and then it just triggers that an event which is similar to an event we had with that person. So sometimes it's just the mind, just like the triggers. Again, that triggers, it's just cause and effect again. Maybe just walking in the garden, you may sort of, somebody outside just is playing a little song on their radio, and you just hear it. Oh, that triggers a memory. You can actually see how memories trigger. You have one little signal or one little present experience, and that's similar to an old experience, and you make the connection, and then you're back there again. That's how memory works, and that's how dreams work. And that's sometimes how karma works. Because karma and dreams work on a very similar mechanism. You may be in a particular mood, and that mood is similar to a mood some time ago, and therefore you can get the karma from that time. That's why if you have bad thoughts, bad states of mind, you are open to bad karma from the past. If you have very beautiful and peaceful and wonderful sort of lovely states of mind, wholesome states of mind, you're opening yourself up to good karma from the past. You're resonating with that. That's how it works. So every time you have a bad state of mind, you're opening yourself up to all the bad karma of your past. But every time you are inspired, you have kindness, you have peace, you're opening yourself up to good karma, which is similar to that in the past. Make sense? Okay, if it doesn't, never mind. Okay. This is crazy. Okay, here we go. Making my bed this morning, I spotted a stain on my pillow. Oh, Ajahn makes me drool. I've never drooled in my sleep before. Closer inspection reveals her hair, curled in such a way that in the dawn light, it looked like the outline of a stain. The mind plays tricks. Phew, for a split second, I thought I'm going to pick up a smelly habit, whereas others attain the jhanas. It's all right to draw, it's just letting go. It's saliva. Above is just an observation. Here's the question. Okay, going down to it. Sometimes the body gets really hot during meditation. Ruling out the symptoms of menopause, this must be a man. It might be sympathetic menopause, because when you get loving kindness and you sympathize with your wife, it might be that way. I don't know. Anyway, ruling out the symptom of menopause, weather conditions, etc. What are the causes and how to overcome it? Okay, first of all, that idea of like when you saw a little hair there and you thought it was a drool on the cushion there. Isn't it amazing that sometimes when we see something, we always give it the worst interpretation? We think, yuck, it's a piece of saliva. It's amazing because what this is called is like the fault-finding mind. Whatever we see, we always interpret it in the very, very worst. It's a stain, it's a sort of, but why not do it in the, have to be like a positive attitude? You know, that's this wonderful hair, maybe be left there by the hair fairy last night. Maybe a relic. Right, maybe, you know, sort of if you've got the real sort of stain in there, they may have been there by the previous owner or something. Actually, that's worse, isn't it, really? But you can look upon it as like, if it's a stain, you look upon it as like being holy water. Holy water from the Davis to drip down. So who knows what it might be?
Maybe she's growing
a mustache. Maybe growing a mustache, yeah. Is that good? I don't know. But whatever it is, you can give it the positive connotation. That's why you've all heard me do this. Whenever we're having a ceremony, especially outside, if it rains, what do we say?
Holy
water, that's right, blessed by the Devas. And if it doesn't rain, we say, oh, we're blessed by the day. We've got a good day for our ceremony. And if it's sort of overcast, we say, you know, it's in the middle between raining and so, we say, oh, we're blessed. Because it's very, very cool when it's overcast. So whatever we do, we say we're blessed. And that way, you've always got a positive mind. And so that's, you know, what I tell people when things go wrong in their life. So you haven't got jhanas, this retreat, you're blessed. Because what happens, I told this to somebody, and it's a very important thing to know. If you have an easy time getting jhanas, and you go straight to enlightenment very quickly, it's great for you, but you don't develop much wisdom. Because, you know, much of your wisdom is actually seeing the mistakes, you've made this, you've done that thing wrong. Because when you know where all the side alleys are, you know, on the path to enlightenment, then you can really help others, because, you know, you've got all that wide wisdom. So you're very, very, very wide. So if it takes a long time going to enlightenment environment, you just can really help others. You're just so wide in your wisdom. It's a short time, it's wonderful, because you get there very quickly. Either way, I don't know, you're on the fast path or the slow path. If you're on the slow path, oh, you're just so compassionate and kind. You're going to be such wise. If you're still on the first step, present moment awareness, even that's a bit dodgy, you're going to be such wonderful, wise people. So when people come up here and say, I had a terrible day today, I couldn't do anything, I said, great, there's another wise teacher in the future. It might be a long time, but one day you'll be there. So that way you encourage people, and it's always good stuff. So anyway, what was I saying? Yeah. Sometimes the body gets hot during meditation there. And that's, I don't know if I said that already, but it happens. I said it to a few people who have, in the interview period, come along. And I mentioned that the last retreat I gave, the Easter retreat, last March or April or something, Somebody asked me that, because in the interview room there, they said I was sitting in meditation, the whole back and shoulders got really hot. So it was really weird, I didn't know what was going on. And I said them straight away, I said, have you got any problems with your back and shoulders? They said, oh yeah, I've got really bad back and terrible shoulders. How do they feel afterwards? Actually, they feel quite good. I said, yeah, that's what happens. When you get very peaceful, and you let go of controlling and tightening up your body, then you find that the body really relaxes. Then if you've noticed after a very deep meditation, the body feels just so relaxed that all the channels of the body are open. And that's what happens. By doing meditation, this quiet meditation, the body really opens up and relaxes. And that gives a chance for the energy flows to actually go through the body. In Chinese medicine, we call that the qi going through the body, the energy flows going through the body. And you all know that the cause of sickness in the Chinese system is blockages in the energy flow. It's the same in the Indian tradition of medicine. The Buddha said it's like winds going through the body get stopped. And that's a cause of sickness. It's a really sort of interesting way of looking at sickness. And it's valid. Because what actually happens when you really meditate, and you get very, very peaceful, those energy flows are not blocked. They become unblocked. And things start to flow. And if there's a problem in your body anywhere, any sort of sickness or any sort of disease or any sort of breakage or bruise or something, that's where the energy will go. When you get concentration of the body's energy in any part of the body, because it's doing this healing, that's called heat. So if you're getting very hot, especially if it's in one part of the body when you're meditating, that is wonderful. Some healing is going on there. And it might be a disease you don't know about, but they're just preventative. The body is very, very smart healing itself, as long as you give it a chance. So, and I know lots of people who have done meditation when they've had operations, and the wounds heal just so quickly. It's amazing just what you can do with meditation, because you allow things to flow, and they do their job, they get all the waste matter away, get all the good stuff there, because you're not tense. You're really, really relaxed. So that's actually probably, if your body gets really hot during meditation, that's really good, because it means your body needed to get hot. So allow it to get hot, and there's some healing going on, especially if it's one part of your body. It gets really, really hot. That's really good stuff. So not only do you learn jhanas here, you know how to heal your body. In the hospital, an offer, what was it, $250 or something? What a bargain. You have to come here next time as well. Why is it that when you are not something, not asked, you don't teach? Like the cause of Pacheka Buddhas. Isn't the best gift being the gift of Dhamma? Should we go back and share our learnings with friends, etc., even if they don't ask? But if, of course, not by force, just share it. Now you've got to be careful not to become a born-again Buddhist. Leave that out of the air. I know the Dhamma. Come here. Actually, they're all Buddhists are born-again Buddhists. Because we believe in reincarnation. So you've all been born again. So we're all born-again Buddhists. But whatever. The point is, I'll tell a story that when I first became a monk in Thailand, I was so inspired. I lived with a monk like Ajahn Chah. Oh, that was just really amazing. And of course, I'd write to my mother every now and again. She was a long way away. And I'd write all these sermons on Buddhism. And how wonderful it was, how great reincarnation was, and jhanas and stuff like that. And when she wrote back to me, she never mentioned anything about what I said about Buddhism. She mentioned about what my brother was doing, what my auntie was doing, what the weather was. She said a lot about the weather because she's always. And then after a while, so the penny dropped, and I wrote a letter to her saying, all this stuff I'm talking to you about Buddhism, how much do you understand? She wrote back, nothing. And I realized, I was being really stupid, I was being evangelical to your mother. I mean, you had a good compassion that you wanted to help her out, but it was the wrong time, the wrong place. And it's the same that sometimes that you know you can, with your friends, with your relations, just be just too over the top when you get inspired. So especially if you have good meditation and have great insights, cool it down. Don't go around this sort of telling other people, you know, about how enlightened you are. Because otherwise we can't play in the net. Well, that does nothing for the reputation of Buddhism. So this is why that the Buddha's teaching was, you don't tell people unless they ask. Because if you tell people and they haven't asked you, they're not really interested, they're not really open. So you're wasting your time. In fact, you're doing worse than wasting your time, you're turning them off. No religion or Buddhism or whatever. And there's far too much of that around them, where people just go around hassling others and telling them about their religions. Remember one of his monks? It was one of his monks was on a train some time ago. It was in England. He happened to be in the same compartment as one of these born-again Christians. And the poor monk got harassed all the way. And of course, sometimes you can't get words in edgewise with these born-again Christians. But then at the right end of the journey, when he was about to get out, this was a few other people, you know, listening to this, finding out what was going on. It was quite entertaining, sort of having, you know, somebody try and convert you. At the end of the journey, before this, this monk, he was putting his hands around this man and said, "Did Jesus say to love each other? I love you. Goodbye." And that made him completely speechless. Just with that one beautiful statement, which he really meant. So the born again was made speechless, which is quite an achievement. So that's sometimes all you need to do simple teachings. You don't need to sort of harass others by teaching when you're not asked. And it's great to teach only when you're asked, because that way, only when people are interested, when they're open, when it's the right time, then you teach. And sometimes it's wonderful when you don't teach. You just sit there. And I wonder, what are you doing? Who are you? Why are you so peaceful? Why are you so kind? And then people get to know. For example, there was this one Sri Lankan who worked in the Department of Minerals and Energy, I think, like the mining department in Perth. And he was what we call a Waisak Buddhist. You know what a Waisak Buddhist is? You only see them at Waisak. The rest of the year you don't see them at all. They don't give any donations. But anyway, he was working in the Department of Minerals and Energy in Perth, and his boss, he told me, was a boss from hell. You know, sometimes you get these bosses in your department and they tell you to do all this work. And you really put all the energy and care, you research everything, do a really good report, they say, do it again, it's not good enough. Or they give you 3 reports to do. And they just give you, if you really work overtime and do really hard work, they give you more work. And they never praise you, they're always asking for more, they're always shouting at you, so the boss from hell. And he hated this guy. It just made his life at work just so unbearable. He said over the space of 2 or 3 months, his boss from hell changed. And he started becoming more reasonable, more kind, less demanding. Actually said he would like to work more for such a boss. He wasn't so afraid of meeting him. And he became so sort of like reasonable and sort of, you know, gentle compared to what he was before. This Sri Lanka couldn't help but ask, "What have you been doing? If you don't mind me saying, before, you know, you were very difficult to work with, but now you're so nice. It doesn't mean I'm taking advantage of you. I want to work for you because, you know, you're so reasonable with me. What have you been doing?" And this boss, this Australian man, said, "Oh, it's amazing. I found this wonderful Buddhist temple in Nolamara. I go there every Friday night, listen to the monks and nun talk there. Oh, I get so much wisdom. So I feel so much better now." And this Sri Lankan said, "The temple in Nolamara, that's my temple." The point was, you'd only go there once a year. But he saw from that boss just how things can change. But the boss wouldn't tell him unless he asked. And he asked because he saw the change in his boss. So there are some of you who may have like brothers, sisters, wives or husbands, they're not all that interested in Buddhism or meditation. You don't need to preach to them. Just wait. If this thing is really working, if it is changing your defilements and getting rid of them, you become such a lovely person to live with, so peaceful, so kind, that they will then get interested. And they will ask you, hey, what did you do at this retreat? You give up your holiday to come all this way and go over there? What did you do? Why did you do it? And then they're asking you. And then you can tell them, because they're really interested. But the best way to spread the teachings, the best way to preach, if you like, is not with all these words, but with your actions. Be kind, be peaceful, be tolerant. And then it shows that this way must be doing something. So that's how we teach the Dhamma. Just by our smile, by our peace, by our forgiveness, by our tolerance. Is that okay? Okay. Thank you for this wonderful retreat. It ain't over yet. The best might yet be to come. Dear Ajahn, for the last 15 years, I've been trying to figure out how to balance the inner and outer life. For many years, I've just concentrated on the inner journey, not wondering about career or what I was supposed to do in the world, because I felt the only true pull to find out what I really am. There have been wonderful moments and very challenging ones too. The journey is still on, and I now feel a need to find out my path in the world also, but not to the detriment of this peace and quiet. The problem is, as soon as I step onto the world, I lose it very quickly. As soon as I step onto the pavement, I step into the dog poo. I feel vulnerable. Can you tell about skillful means of being in the world but not of the world? I have no call at this stage to become a nun. Aha. I've been working on you for the last 9 days, brainwashing you. You don't know yet. Don't get scared, I don't do that. So, you're interested in the inner journey but also interested sort of in actually how to do that in the world. And again, that usually if the inner journey goes well and you're at peace with yourself and you've got inner energy and you've got sort of direction in life, it's very easy to work in the world. Because what it really means is that when there's nothing to do, you can really rest. When there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. That's actually why when I was doing the chanting the last couple of days, I thought, let's give it everything I've got. Really put energy into it. It's much more fun when you put energy into it. It's like giving talks or answering questions. I give it everything I've got. Because if I just was boring and just read these questions out in a monotone, I would like to thank you for giving us this excellent dungeon. Outstanding meditation questions. So, so you've got to put anything you've got into it, and then people liven up, and I liven up. So that's what you do in the world. Give it everything you've got when you're working. When it's time to do nothing, be quiet. Be still. So you can let things go. Find a career, because you've got to sort of survive in this world. And if you don't like working, even being a monk is not an option, because you work very hard as a monk as well. Don't like working, then get reborn as a cat or a dog. Right, you've got to work sometimes. But there are lots of really wonderful jobs people can do. I'm really impressed how many people do like social work. And working in old people's homes or in hospitals or whatever, to really actually help. And so their work is like compassionate and it's really good and it's the right livelihood. They don't get as much money as if you worked in the stock market or the casino or something, but it's good livelihood, you feel good about yourself and you know how to live a simple life. You don't need a big mansion. You just be in a small house with lots of friends. So whatever, you can do wonderful things in the world. So your work is also your compassionate action for others. And even if you've got just a simple job, just like a bus driver, as one person said to me, they thought, oh, I'm only a bus driver, how good is that in life? It's an amazing thing you can do there. You can actually, every time people come on the bus, just smile at them, make them happy. Just a little kindness goes such a long way in this world. And how many people do you meet on a bus every day as the driver? Just those are the number of people you could influence. You can give a little bit of happiness to. It's amazing what you can give, what you can do. So whatever you're doing in your work, it's amazing what you can do. Just go that little bit of an extra way to make people happier. Your customers will be more happy with you. And because they're more happy, they will want more business with you. Your sales go up, your company gets a better reputation. It's amazing what just a little smile, a little kindness can do. You've got, it doesn't take much time. So that way that you're putting these practices into your lifestyle, and it's amazing what you can do. Because when I said again this morning about compassion and stuff, we always have to be compassionate at all times of our life. Compassion at our work, compassion as we get home, compassion to ourselves when there's nothing to do. In other words, being peaceful with oneself. And that way you can do really, really well in the world. So find something you can do. And give it everything you've got. And that way, in the lay life, you can balance sort of your commitment to like peace, but also your commitment to do something for the world. Those are your duties. See what you can do. That's the last question. I'll give another talk tomorrow about bringing the practice into the world with some more stories. Okay. Now, I'll read this question out boringly. Now I'll read it out in the normal way. I would like to thank you for giving us this excellent Dharma talk and outstanding meditation coaching. It's written by Ajahn Brahm. Hey, big sorry to you. No, it's not my handwriting. For the organizers and his committee on organizing this outstanding retreat for us, a big sadhu to you. It's not outstanding, it's out-sitting. So, thank you for the organizers' committee for organizing this out-sitting retreat for us. A big sadhu to you. For all my yogi friends, thank you for your smiling faces and rule and role model which motivate me. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Wish all of us will meet in the jhana plane. Yes, see you in jhana. When you go in the jhana plane, if you get reborn, this jhana plane is so stable, if you actually die and get into the jhana plane, you live there for many, many eons. Sometimes they're eons long. So it does give a lot of time to the slow coaches to catch up and meet you there, because you're going to be there a long time. So you've got 40 lifetimes, or 40 eons to actually get there. Okay, you had a story where the farmer had a bull that can pull 100 carts of the landlord. This is a story of kindness. Could you kindly tell so that we can share with our kids? It's not actually in my little book, is it? Nandi Vishala the Ox. No, you know the story of Nandi Vishala the Ox? That's actually, I know this story because sometimes you are like boxes and I try to sort of watch the breath, and this is why I'm so soft and kind. Say, please, nice yogi, just watch the breath a little bit, a tiny bit, just for once, in the present moment, you know, just 5 minutes, that's enough, not all day. And when you're kind, people want to do it, because Nandi Vishala the Ox, one of the great Buddhist stories. In the time of the Buddha, this was thousands of years before Walt Disney, the animals could speak. And there was this ox. He was a huge fellow. He was so big. Some people thought he was the strongest ox in the whole of India. And so did he. Because one day he came up to his master and said, "Master, you work so hard. I've seen you sweat, you pull the plow, you have to stay up, get up really early in the morning to the farming and go to bed late at night, looking after your wife and your family. I've got so much compassion for you. Look, I can make you richer than your wildest dreams if you follow my plan. You can retire early and you can, instead of working in the fields, you can go to the Buddhist Society retreats whenever you want. You can go," he didn't say that, I'm just making that up. But when you've got lots of money, you're free. And so the man said, "What do I need to do? How can I make some money?" He said, "Listen, I, Nandi Vishala, am the strongest ox in the whole of India. I can pull 100 carts all full of stones tied together. And the man said, no ox can do that. He said, I can do that. I'm super ox. Nadivisana, the super ox. He said, now listen, I know that no one will believe that, but listen, I can do that. There's a man in the village who's so wealthy. You make him a bet, a wager. Say $10,000. That I, Nandivisthala the ox, can pull 100 carts all full of stones. He said, I haven't got $10,000 in his own. It doesn't matter, you're not going to lose $10,000, you're going to make $10,000. It's sure, absolute, 100% certainty. Small investment, big returns. And so, the man sort of believed it. So, he made that bet with a rich person. $10,000, so my ox can pull 100 carts all full of rocks. And the rich man said, now listen, I don't want to take your money. So no ox can do that. He said, my ox can. Lord, don't be stupid. Yeah, my ox can. Okay, I warned you. So they had to get all the carts in the village. Because you don't, you know, even he hasn't got 100 carts. They have to borrow a cart from here, a cart from there, and all the villagers had to help put all these rocks into the carts. And of course they were interested. You know, can an ox do this? Because he was a big fellow. And so they tied all the carts together with the rocks in them. And they tied the ox to the front cart. And the owner got on the top there with everybody watching, especially the rich man, because $10,000 at stake. And the man, the owner of the ox, said, come on, you stupid fellow, pull these carts. And the ox didn't move. But I told you, pull the carts! Still he didn't move. And the fellow started getting very afraid. He was about to use $10,000 he didn't have. And people were starting to snigger at the stupidity of the owner. He got a stick and he hit the ox. Come on, move or else! But the ox couldn't move. Even though he hit him many times, the ox couldn't move. Obviously, the rocks, the weight was just too heavy. And the poor man had to climb down from the top car, ashamed and afraid, ruined. He'd have to sell whatever land he had, his house, everything. He was bankrupt. He was done. And everyone was laughing at his stupidity. He went to a root of a tree and started weeping. He was crying and crying. Why did he believe that stupid ox? When he felt a wet nose in his ear, he looked around and it was his ox. And the ox said, why are you crying, master? Because I knew you, stupid ox. You've lost me $10,000. You said you could, you'd lie to me. He said, I don't lie, master. You did lie. You said you can pull 100 carts or full of stones. And you can't. I can, but you can't. Yes, I can. Well, why didn't you? Because you called me stupid. You shouted at me and you hit me. That's not the right way to treat an ox. And so I said, oh, I'm sorry. Just excitement and greed, whatever. Now, said Nadivisthala, I can still make you rich beyond your wildest dreams. You go back, the cars are still there. You go back to the rich man. This time you bet him, let's make it $30,000. That I, Nandivisthala, super ox, the strongest ox in India, can pull those 100 carts. But this time, you speak nicely to me. So he went back there with the ox and said, that was just a test. Now I bet you 30,000. And my ox will put all those carts. You don't even need to load them, they're already there. And so the man said, easy money. Off you go. So they tied the ox to the front car again. And the owner, the master, went up to the front car. You know what happened this time? He said, dear ox, oh kind ox, you've served me so long in this life. I know this is a very, very heavy weight. But if you don't mind, if you do mind, don't worry about it. Let's don't do it. Let go. But if you don't mind, you just try and maybe just, if it's not too much trouble, just put in these lips, if it's okay with you, okay? And because he was so kind and compassionate, the ox stretched every muscle. He strained and he pulled like no ox has ever pulled in the whole history of India, either before or since. You know what happened? Nothing. Those were heavy carts. If it's too much, said the owner, give up, it's all right. Doesn't matter. No, you can still be friends. And so the ox tried even harder. And sweat started coming off his haunches. You could see the veins protruding in his flanks. And he pulled even harder. And still nothing happened. He said, oh look, leave it alone. Give it up. I don't want you to kill yourself or hurt yourself, ox. It's all right. Never mind. I forgive you. And at that, because of such great compassion, the ox gave a superhuman pull. Not superhuman, super ox. And as he pulled like no other ox could even be thought of pulling, there was a slight creak. Only a slight one at first, but it got louder. Something was moving. And he pulled even harder. You know what it's like when you pull a heavy weight. At first, only a tiny bit moves, but then you could see the wheels of the first car moving, and the second, and the third. He was pulling those cars. And once they were moving, it wasn't that hard. And that ox pulled all those 100 carts to the cheers of all the people, and to the great distress of the rich man who lost 20,000. He got 10,000 from the first bet, lost 30 in the second. And that man, the owner of the ox, could now retire, and so could Manu Sama. And his last days were just eating grass, the very best grass, as a share of the 20 grand he made for his master. And that was the story of Manu Sama. It's the Buddha said it. Tony said, look, you don't get anywhere by shouting, by calling people stupid, by hitting them. Not even if it's your husband. Not if it's your wife. If you want to get something out of your wife, say, oh dear wife, kind wife, oh you looked after me so much, this is a wonderful wife. Do you mind if I can go on a retreat this weekend? If it's too much, don't worry, I'll stay. Oh dear son, dear daughter, now I know you're studying very, very hard. If you just study a little bit hard, you basically... No, no. There's a kindness. So you can do that to your mind. You get your mind to pull meditation much harder, with greater success if you're kind to it. But if you say, you stupid mind, you beat your mind, stupid, stupid, stupid mind. You've been here 8 days already, and you still can't get up in the morning, you still can't watch the breath, you still can't do it, stupid, stupid, stupid. Of course you're not going to get anywhere. So just say, kind, gentle mind. And it works. So that's the power of compassion. It's much stronger than force. You try it. It works. Work for Nandi Visala. And it will work for you. That's actually what I think Mr. Bush should have done. Oh dear, oh sorry. Anyway, come on. Dear Adam, can a yogi refuse to get out from his deep meditation for good so he can straight enter the jhana path? Okay, this is the refusenik yogi who rebels, doesn't want to come out. No, because in the jhana you can't tell yourself to carry on, you can't tell yourself to stop. It's a natural process, it's not up to you. If you say, I'm going to sort of stay in jhana sort of for the next 10 days, or you can't do this, because it's a natural process. So you stay in that jhana for the length of time, I call it the momentum of letting go. If you really let him go, if you went to a jhana, you really let him go, you stay in there for a long time. You only just slightly let him go, you go in there for a short time. Just the power of renunciation, how much you've abandoned. That's what keeps you in the meditation a long time. But what people do If you start getting into these states often, you can actually program the jhana. Before you go in, you can say, because you may have an appointment, I'll only go in for 2 hours. After 2 hours, I'll come out. And the mind does it. Really tremendous. It doesn't need a clock. You just know when 2 hours it is. And it'll just come out when you want it to. Okay, any questions about that? Next question. Ajahn, I just wanted to say much metta and heaps of merit for all the kind of wonderful people who put so much of their time and energy, and of course all the food, to make it possible for us to have a blissful retreat. Thank you. Okay, very good. Some nice thanks. That's just like saying to Nandu Sala, oh, thank you so much for putting those out of the carts. There's 200 over there, $50,000 off. Are you into it? Of course, Nandu Sala said, yeah, of course. Your card. First of all, I'd like to apologize for any offense my question may cause. Yeah. It is an honest question. No. Okay. Alright, this is a Saturday night question, so I hope no one feels embarrassed about this. I'm just reading out. I didn't write this. Are there any precedents whereby a person who is either a virgin and or who has no positive experience in a relationship has become a monk nun and has attained enlightenment? With so little experience, wouldn't a monk or nun run the risk of either disrobing out of a combination of lust and sheer curiosity, or not acknowledging the reality of their lust and then perhaps getting nowhere in their practice? Perhaps even running the risk of developing diseases such as prostate cancer. Apparently, the research has shown that among at least some communities of Christian nuns, cervical cancer is a problem. Why should monastic communities of other traditions be any different? Meta. Okay, it's an interesting question. I haven't fielded that one before. Okay, it's actually, I don't know, I think in the my experience anyway of other monks, if they have had like relationships before they become monks, I think it's much better. At least they know what they're giving up. They've got some experience. Otherwise, you know, it's like the mystery. And with a mystery, when we don't really know what we're talking about, whether it's sex or relationships or something, that sometimes that people amplify, you know, what they don't know is what the mind does. And sometimes you think, oh, it might be wonderful. Oh, wouldn't sex be interesting? Oh, wouldn't be getting married wonderful? Because they don't know what it is. And sometimes, because of desire, we actually amplify things. So sometimes it is, you know, a little bit more helpful if, like a monk or a nun has had some sort of experiences before, a little bit of a relationship or sex or something, because at least they know what they've been doing. However, it is not imperative. If a person comes to me and says, I want to become a monk, but I haven't had any experience yet, I don't say, off you go. Come back tomorrow. I'm not going to say that. Although, this is in the Thai tradition in Northeast Thailand, I've said this at ordination ceremonies, they used to do this, they don't do it now, we certainly do not do it here in Perth. But in the morning, they're going to get ordained in the afternoon, in the morning they take the candidate, they actually take him on like a palanquin, like, you know, like a chair which they're holding up, and they take him into all the old halls first of all. They take him into the pub or the bars, and then they take him into the houses of ill repute, especially to show what he's missing first of all. Maybe just, are you sure? And then they take him to the monastery to ordain. We don't do that here. It really depends, because what happens is that if a person gets a meditation together, then they will get the happiness of renunciation. It's the happiness of peace. And then basically the monk or nun won't be interested in sex because they've got something more peaceful, more blissful, more beautiful. And they won't need relationships because they've got loving kindness with everybody. Why have a relationship with one person? When you can, now why have someone who's special when you can actually spread your loving kindness all over the place? So like as a monk, sometimes people think, oh monks, you don't know intimacy. You do know intimacy with yourself, but not sexual intimacy. You have intimacy of loving kindness, good friendship. And you share, you know, problems which you have. And so that, I think that, yeah, sometimes there's something positive if a person's had a relationship before, but sort of it's not absolutely necessary. I think these days, though, that most young men, especially Australians, have relationships. So, you know, there's no problem there at all. Maybe in the old days they didn't have them. But I think they know what's going on. So, sometimes I haven't had a relationship. Sometimes I take them with me when I do the counselling. People come and say all their problems and all their stuff, and they say, oh, I'm so happy to be a monk. Because you all know the three rings of marriage. What's the first ring of marriage? Engagement ring. What's the second ring of marriage? The wedding ring. What's the third ring of marriage? Supper ring, yeah. So, but actually, as for health, I think that maybe if it was in a religion where they suppress their sexuality, in other words, they don't actually deal with it, just hold it back and say, no, I haven't got sexuality or whatever, then there'll be a problem, I think. And that may be where prostate cancer or cervical cancer comes from, because it's a suppressed sexuality. But I think in Buddhism it's like a transcended sexuality. So you're not, you know, suppressing anything, you acknowledge what's happening, and through your meditation the whole sort of that sexual urge just fades away. Because you've got another happiness, a greater peace. And it's with that insight, with that, especially the experiences in deep meditation, the insight space of honor, sexuality just fades. So you're celibate, not because you're trying hard not to, you're not just enduring, you're transcending. So the sexuality isn't there anymore. Isn't that wonderful? You can look at a woman, even a young, pretty woman, they're just a person, that's all. You can treat them as a person, rather than as a sex object, or as like a possible partner. It's much more wonderful being, to be able to do that. And you know, always, you know, whenever you meet somebody of the opposite gender, you know, do they like me? What are they thinking? Is it going to be this or going to be that? You can just actually be with a person. I know that sometimes, I must admit, I've got this fascination. Sometimes when a beautiful woman comes, you know, really sort of dressed up, and I don't sort of pay them any attention, I can see they get sort of a bit disappointed. Because they're used to having power, and I don't give them that power over men. Because imagine, if you are a very attractive woman, or a very attractive man, I don't know, then you actually have power of the other gender. And then you feel that, you know, that you, people get attracted, they look at you, you know, they sort of smile at you. But when you actually you transcend that, and these people haven't got power over you, now sometimes I've seen them, I can feel them get, you know, who is this guy? He's not looking at me. And actually that's an interesting thing to do. The same when I went to teach some meditation in Sydney. There's one of the ex-monks, who's a good friend, and went to his meditation group. And this particular occasion, it was actually in quite an expensive area of Sydney. So in his meditation group, there's some quite wealthy people. There's this one lady who was looking at me and smiling. Yeah, it's quite a good looking lady, smiling at me. And, you know, I just, I don't know, I'm just teaching meditation, looking at other people. And she was really pissed off at me. I found out afterwards. And I asked why. Because she's actually a very famous TV star. She's on many of the television dramas and soap operas in Australia. I didn't recognise her. And that's why she's really upset. Because she was so used to everybody recognising, oh, it's that person. Oh, it's her. Oh, I've seen you on TV. Well, I hadn't seen her on TV. Don't watch TV. So she was just a normal girl to me. And so she didn't like that. It's fascinating sometimes. Actually, it happened to George Bush Senior, apparently, when he first went over to England. He had a sort of reception. And this is reported in the papers. It really made me laugh. This is, you know, George Bush Senior. He was president of the United States, and he was at this cocktail party. But one moment, sort of, he was alone. This woman, this English woman, came up to me and said, "I know, hi, I'm Anne so-and-so. Who are you?" I said, "I'm the president of the United States." I'd come off it. He was. And he was really upset. And she was being honest, you know, she didn't recognise him. Watching newspapers or whatever. So sometimes it does upset people when you don't recognise as being a beautiful person or being famous. But sometimes as monks you don't see that.
Ajahn?
Yeah.
Well, just wanted to ask a question about that passion versus public finance. I think my experience of that is that it's almost a political. In other words, when you've got, if you've got a high passion, you've got a low level of kindness. If you've got a high level of kindness, then the passion doesn't sort of seem to, doesn't have any power,
just sort of, doesn't it? Could be that, yeah, because your loving kindness is actually more more wide. It's not some just on one particular person. It's more like selfless. Because a lot of passion is like what I want from that relationship.
We seem to be also that one of the ingredients for intimacy is loving kindness rather than passion.
Yeah, I think so.
People actually talk about intimacy and swinging the chandelier and all that sort of stuff, but it's actually not real intimacy. It's about projecting your sense of what you want, what you think you are, onto the other person's sort of playing screen, and they understand you. Whereas I think loving kindness is something where you actually really have a sense of you and the other person. I wish you could see two people in the situation. What's your view about that? Because you know, one of the things you've also talked about is this whole issue of intimacy and being
Well, again, you know that symbol which I give, the acid test to find out whether you really love your partner.
What do you do? What if you are happy saying, yeah, look, I really would be happy. If you want to be with someone else, I would really be happy for you to do that, and you really believe that.
Yeah, that's really true. That's real loving kindness. That's selflessness.
Okay, so that's a really good test, huh?
Yeah, that's the acid test then. For those of you who haven't heard that one before. So then, if you really love your partner, don't you really want them to be happy? Isn't that your main concern? You fall in love, I really, really want you to be happy and well. That's my biggest goal in life, your happiness, not mine. And to be able to test that, you come on retreat and your husband or your wife is back home. Where you go back to LA or Singapore, wherever you came from, you find a note on the door of your apartment. Your wife has run off with your best friend. She's fallen in love. She's run off with him. How would you feel? If you get really upset and mad and you don't love her, you just love her being with you. If you really loved her, her happiness was a major thing. You'd be ecstatic, over the moon, overjoyed that she's even more happy with your best friend than she ever was with you. Oh, you're having such a wonderful time, my darling. Oh, you're so happy. Oh, that makes me happy. If it was real loving kindness, you say, the door of my heart's open to you, whatever you do, I just want you to be happy. Could you do that? You can't. But if it's really selfless, some people actually can do that. It's amazing. Just that when they love somebody, it's not like, oh, what I can get out of this. It really is what I can give.
There's a follow on from that, Ajahn, that if in fact you are in a state with another person, then what you can see to be a relationship is very different from what society perceives it to be, because it's almost like two people who have a sense of capacity can connect at a deep level, but almost at the same breath, there's quite a hatred, quite certain different go their own way.
Yep.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, yeah. Yeah, go on.
That's just a question. Can people have a friendship without attachment? I mean, like a deep friendship without there being attachment?
Yeah, you can have a friendship without attachment. It's called, actually, in the Buddhism, Kalyanamitta, the noble friend. Someone who can actually help you along the path, help you to let go more, to encourage you to be a better person, but without owning you. So you can share. Next question. Here we go. Is it okay to do counting of breath, and what are the better ways of counting? Thank you. These days, the better ways is use a calculator. Because people have a hard time counting, even up to 9 these days. So a couple of years ago, I was ordering some bricks from the brickyard. We wanted 100 bricks, and they were something like $210 a thousand. And 100 bricks is so many dollars a thousand. They had to use a calculator to work it out, just sort of just moving the decimal point my way. I was disgusted. But there are many ways of counting. And the way I do counting meditation, I haven't said this in this retreat, I've said it in other retreats. if you really want to sort of use counting, the most that I used was I counted breathing in one, breathing out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four, out four, in five, out five, in six, out six, in seven, out seven, in eight, out eight, in nine, out nine, up to nine. That was nine breaths. And I start again at one, in one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six, seven, seven, in eight, out eight. I stop at eight next time. And in one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six, in seven, out seven. And in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out two, out three, four, four, up to six anyway. And up to five. In one, out one, in two, out two, in three, in four, out four, up to four. And in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, up to three. In one, out one, in two, out two, up to two. And then lastly, in one, out one. Because that made it sort of more interesting. And it also meant that I'd have to be very careful, I was mindful of where I was, of what part of the cycle I was in. And that was actually a thing, I worked out 45 breaths long. And to actually, if I completed one cycle, I was actually mindful of those 45 breaths. But what happened when sometimes when you started that, especially early in the morning when you're a bit tired, you lost your mindfulness and you found in 16, out 16, you forgot to stop. Or sometimes you just didn't know where you were. So I'd always actually start at the beginning again. That was one way I did counting. But you can do counting so many different ways. But if you do the counting, don't do it for too long. If you do it for too long, you just get a headache. Okay. Ajahn, is the Buddha's teaching, is there any reference to the heart and its role? Okay. Sometimes there is, well, sometimes this word heart, whether it's like the physical heart or the heart of you, sometimes they have, like, Hadiyawatu. That's actually mostly the commentary. Sometimes they say that's the seat of the idea of a soul, but that's all rubbish because people have heart transplants. But do you know that sometimes when people have heart transplants, sometimes they have a remainder of the original person? Because I think we've got this little book, this interesting stories of people with heart transplants. It only happens to a fraction, maybe 5%. There's a few cases, the one major one was where this young girl had a heart transplant, maybe about 11 or 12, she had some trouble with her heart. And when she had recovered and was at home, she started having nightmares. Nightmares of being chased down by an alley and killed by this big man. And, you know, first of all, the mother decided just a nightmare, she had a difficult operation, but it kept on recurring. So she went to the doctor and said, look, my daughter's having these recurring nightmares. And the doctor said, look, it's a very traumatic operation, you know, just taking one heart in and out and putting another one. You don't know what sort of complications. Leave her alone, it'll get better. But it never went better, she still had these nightmares. And so the mother started thinking, because of exactly the same nightmare, being chased down by an alley and killed by this big man. So she started making some inquiries. She had some few friends in the police department. She managed to find out where the heart came from. And it came from a woman who was murdered in an alley. And the police became very interested. And they interviewed the girl, who remembered those nightmares very easily. What was happening? Where was the alley? And it was a clear description of the alley where this murder took place. And she gave a clear description of this man who was supposed to have killed her. And that was enough for them to go and question that man. And the man confessed it was him. They caught the murderer of the previous owner's heart. Isn't that fascinating? And the other story, which I think Ajahn Jnana got this book, this is the other story which he told, was this person, his wife, who was about 40 or 50, and she was very, very prudish and priggish, not at all sort of tender to him. But she had a heart operation. When she recovered, she started becoming very, very affectionate. I think the story says she started to become very frisky. In other words, she was very, very sexual. And he did some inquiries and found out that her heart had actually come from a young prostitute. And And they said he was very satisfied with your work. But don't get any ideas if you've got an old wife. But actually, apparently, though, that those effects, they only last a very short time, but they sort of disappear. And then they sort of go back to the ordinary person again. Yeah.
I just wonder whether that's because the person who died, like the woman who was murdered, had a strong attachment to her own body. And so it was more of a, you know, like a ghost coming to that person.
That's actually a valid interpretation, explanation. That's actually the one which I suggested was the case. Not that the soul lived in my heart. If it did, that would actually last for a long, long time. But it was just the attachment, which people do have. I mean, ghost stories. You've got that famous ghost story of that plane which went down in the Everglades of Florida. And then the captain, most of the crew were killed, but the plane wasn't actually badly damaged. So they rescued the plane and used it for spare parts in the same airline. And in every plane which had a spare part, they had visualization, they had appearances of those ghosts, manifestations. And they knew it was there because sometimes the captain would be sitting down there and one of the air stewardesses could recognize him. Because, you know, they'd worked together on many flights. Ah, it's the captain who was dead and he just vanished. There's actually a very, very well documented ghost story. But the important part was it was just in those planes which had parts from the crash plane, as if there was some sort of attachment still lingering there with the plane in which they died. As if, like, there's still some attachment there with the heart which they once had. So yeah, that's a valid explanation.
There's parts of it that you know what, we better just take them all out.
Okay, right, yeah, that's right. Put them in the ghost machine. There are some monks in Thailand are very good in black magic, which can harm and endanger a person's life. And these monks offer services upon request. Did Buddha say something about this black magic, how to prevent and avoid? Actually, the way to overcome black magic, you all know that, is keeping 5 precepts. You keep your precepts, you cannot be harmed. This is another of those weird stories from Thailand. Already told that story about that Thai lady whose mother was sick and the medium couldn't get close, had a powerful because he was keeping 8 precepts. This is in close to our monastery in Thailand, that one of the supporters of, you know, this is Wat Nana Chao, the monastery where I grew up, Rajanyala is the abbot there now. Some of you have been there. That one of the supporters who would always offer alms, would actually come to the monastery on the 8 precept days, no, not very, maybe in her 20s, that she was brushing her teeth one day, washing her face, she looked in the mirror, and it wasn't her face in the mirror. It was this, like, demon in the mirror. She saw the demon so clearly, she, you know, freaked out. It wasn't just, you know, she was perfectly awake, she looked in the demon, it wasn't her face, she saw the reflection of this terrible monster. So when that happens, they go to the monks, and they, you know, ask the monks what to do. And the monks said, well, because this was a very, very good lady, and she wasn't imagining the only time in her life something like this had happened. They said, well, maybe it might be some sort of ghost. We'll go to your house, you offer us the meal, the dhana, we'll do some chanting and see what happens. And so the monks from our monastery, but one of the elder disciples of Ajahn Chah went there as well. And I think when they were at that service there, somebody went into a trance. They went unconscious. When they woke up, they were speaking in a strange voice. And so the elder monk asked, who are you, what do you want? It was actually this demon that actually possessed this lady. And it wasn't the lady, you know, who actually saw the vision. And then after some questioning, it came out this demon had actually been hired to kill this girl. Don't know why, so this is black magic. This is what actually happens in black magic. That some of the monks or some of the lay people, they got control over demons. It's almost that the demons have to do something for that monk. There's a payoff in the back and the monk really, really suffers as a result. But at that time they got power. This demon was contracted to kill that girl. He said he'd been trying for 2 or 3 years. could never succeed because the girl was keeping very, very good virtue and precepts. That was what was protecting her, and the demon couldn't get close. And so that's why the monk told the demon, look, it's better that you leave her alone. But this demon actually said, look, if I don't kill her, I have to die. And the monk said, well, it's better you die. I'll give you 5 precepts, first of all, so you get a good rebirth. And after much encouraging, the demon accepted. And he gave this lady in trance 5 precepts. It was at the demon's voice, taking them. And then she went completely unconscious. When she woke up again, she was a normal self. And that was the last time the demon was seen or heard of. Just one case out of many, where if you keep those 5 precepts, especially 8 precepts every now and again, you are stronger than demons. They can't touch you. The black magic can't hurt you. If they do try, it rebounds back on them. So that is the best protection from black magic.
Does the demon manifest and try and do the person in by self-sabotage?
I don't know exactly how they do it, but sometimes, whatever they do, they make the person sick and the person dies. Not quite sure how, but it's all done through the agency of these lower beings. Yeah?
Did you say a little while ago that if you have strong mind, that your mind is strong and you try to cast hatred towards someone, that it would sap your mental energy?
Yes,
that's true. If you are powerful enough to
punish a demon,
wouldn't that just
self-destruct? You don't have that power because you've got powerful minds. It's other reasons. People tell me some stories. I don't pay too much attention to those stories. I just tell people have powerful minds. But there's other ways of actually getting control of these demons. Sometimes if you own one, you can actually sell it to somebody else. Or something. I'm not quite sure exactly how you get it from your teacher, hands it over to you as their disciple. So you get like temporal power, but it's not your power. You can't do it yourself. You have to use this other agency. There's a famous case of the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, who got into very deep meditation, got psychic powers, but then started to become proud and use those psychic powers for either his own personal advancement or eventually to try and supplant the Buddha. And as soon as he started having such unwholesome thoughts, immediately he lost all his powers. There's another example that if you don't have a pure mind, you can't sustain those powers at all. So that's actually the real psychic powers which come from you. That magic is not using your powers, it's using other people's. Basically that these demons, low beings. Yeah? Sorry? Manipulation, yeah. You manipulate or control these beings. It's some sort of deal done, which you have to pay off later on. But in that time, the demon has to do what you tell it. So there's not anyone who gets involved in black magic, they get just so psychologically and physically just damaged. I don't know why anybody wants to do that, it's just the law of power for a short time, you've got to pay it back afterwards. So it's a very stupid thing to do. Very bad karma. Yeah. Mental protection, yeah, both. Because it actually works mostly on the mental plane. So, you are all safe, as long as you're not naughty. There are some professions like judges, politicians, whose role contradicts Buddhists. There are some professions like judges, politicians. There are some professions like judges, politicians, whose roles make it tougher to practice. What would be your advice to those in the profession, but who later become Buddhists? And actually, I remember a time when this politician, he was an ex-prime minister of Thailand, and at that time he was a chief in the Privy Council of the King of Thailand, and it was his job to sign the death warrants. If anyone was to be executed, he was the one who had to sign the warrant for the execution to take place, even though it was the royal prerogative, the king actually gave it to him to do. That was Sanya Tamasak, those of you tied to. And he went up to Ajahn Chah once when I was there and told him and said, look, he's a very devout Buddhist. He said, am I breaking my precepts by doing this? What should I do? He said, yeah, you are. You should do it. He said, but I'm the chief privy council. I've got to do it. He said, no, you don't. Give it to someone else, was I? And that was Ajahn Chah's idea of that, that if you get to that point, then just don't do the job. Sometimes there was one of his disciples who was drafted into the army. Didn't have any choice, had to go, even though he's a monk. If the monks had to pass his basic exams, he don't have to go in the army. This was a forest monk, don't do exams. So when his literary number came up, he had to go into the army. And he said, what should I do? I don't want to be in the army, I'm a monk. Should I just, you know, just disappear into the forest and be a monk? He said, no, you've got to do your duty, you've got to keep the law. So you go to Israel and become a monk. It's only for 2 years, then you can come back again after your service. He said, what happens if I'm in a firefight and there's the enemy coming towards me and I have to shoot? He said, well, shoot to miss. Make sure you train very carefully in the firing range so you get an accurate shot. And then make sure when they come, make sure you miss. He said, and your officers won't know. He said, that was the advice. And so he did that for 2 years. He was in the army. And then whenever there was anyone to shoot at, they all miss. And after 2 years, he was accepted back again, ordained as a monk, and that was one of Ajahn Chah's senior teachers. So if you have to go in the army, shoot and miss. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, I get much joy offering Dada today, but I will get much, much, much more joy if the merits are given to the cooks and the kitchen helpers. Usually we only share merits with those people who are dead. Cooks and kitchen helpers are still alright. They are the ones that got all dirty, oily and smelly. And I, squeaky clean, only stood at the table for barely 5 minutes. Scooping some food. Where is justice? Thank you. Now they all got good karma. They all got happiness. So whoever does good things will always get it. Whether you want it or not, it just comes. Sometimes you ever sort of get good luck and good fortune. This one of my old friends when I was a young monk in Thailand, he was actually the builder of the Ajahn Chah's, we call it his like hospital hut in Wat Pa Pong. When Ajahn Chah got very ill, he needed not just an ordinary hut, he needed a special hut with everything there. And so this monk, who was a good friend of mine, the same year or 1 year junior to me, he's a good friend, he's from Sydney. Interesting actually that he was very brilliant, but he's a really good builder. He was like a tiler. And I said the first year he was building, he won like the award in New South Wales for Apprentice of the Year or something. But he said he never did any good at school. And I couldn't really figure that out because he was really, really sharp. And one day we had a copy of Time magazine, had an article there on dyslexia. He came up to me and said, this is me. This is why I've never been able to do any good at school. He was dyslexic, but at that time no one recognised it. If they'd have recognised it, he'd have gone to university and did amazing things. He was just so sharp and smart. But anyway, that he was a good builder, so he spent a year building this hut for Ajahn Chah. And he really put a lot of effort on working to it. And then eventually came back to Australia, eventually to Israel, and I lost contact with him. But last year, Ajahn Yana told me that he appeared in the northeast of Thailand. And he went over to Wat Pa Pong, the monastery where he built this hut, Ajahn Chah's monastery, and gave this huge donation. When he asked him why and where he got the money from, he said he just won the Australian lotto. And he thought that the reason why he won that first prize, that's quite a few million, was because of his good karma for building this hut for his teacher. And so having got that money, he made a special trip to actually to repay some of the debt, the good karma he'd made, and made him a millionaire. Isn't that a lovely story? Good karma actually does work. Dear Ajahn Brahm, are Nagas real like the Devas which exist in the heavenly realm? They must have accumulated lots of merit to be reborn in the heavenly realms. Why are they not born Devas? Just curious, thank you. Nagas. You know what Naga is? These are the dragons. They're supposed to, they're actually a special type of being, and they're like big snakes who can sometimes take the form as human beings. So there might be some nagas here. According to the old story, that's actually in the ordination of monks. We have to ask a person, as part of the thing, we have to ask them, are you a naga or are you a human being? Because nagas are prohibited from being monks. They can take on the form of human beings, because what happened once, there was this naga, this huge like serpent snake who could transform into a human being. And he really, really wanted to be a monk. He had so much faith. So he took the form as a human being, did a bit of training, was ordained as a monk by the, by the Buddha, by somebody. But that time there was so many monks, they had to share huts. And the Buddha said there's two times when a naga has to go back to its natural shape of a snake. One is when they're having sexual intercourse, the other time is when they're sleeping. So when this newly ordained monk was really a naga, went to sleep, he waited for the other monk to go to sleep first of all, but when the other monk woke up, his fellow monk was in there, there's a huge snake! So he jumped out screaming. And the naga sort of woke up, changed his shape, it's only me. And of course they told the Buddha, and the Buddha had to tell the naga to come. He said, look, we can't have nagas becoming monks. And the naga started crying. You really, really want to be a monk? He said, no, I'm sorry, we can't have that. Give you the five precepts. But the poor naga was so sad. The Buddha said, well, we'll give you this wonderful, we'll give you one thing which we'll always remember you by. Any young person, or any person who's actually prepared or just about to become a monk, we call them nagas in your memory. And to this day that somebody is about to become a monk, we call them nagas. In Thai, nark. Have you heard that before? Narkor. It's a person about to become a monk. Comes from the Pali, a naga. It's just that particular time. So there are such things as nagas. And if you don't believe me, if you have the time, I'm not sure if it's still happening at Himmakpeng, the Naga Fireballs and the Pawana Day, it's still happening up there?
Yes.
Very good. Who's seen those? Anyone seen those? The Naga Fireballs? Did you see those, Larry? Because you've been to what, yeah, Himmakpeng?
I've not personally seen, because it normally happens only on this
Pawana Day, yeah.
On the special days.
Yeah.
But it's very well documented.
It is, yeah.
Thousands of people go up there.
This is in the Mekong River,
yeah.
Just a little downstream of Vientiane. And there, every year, only on one day, which is a full moon night of October, which marks the ends of the rainy season retreat, the Wasa, the Kansa. Only on that day, fireballs come out from the river, rise into the air and explode. And Ajahn Tate, one of Ajahn Mun's disciples, a great monk, would often say that was nagas. There was a big group of nagas at that point, deep under the Mekong, who would always celebrate the end of the rains retreat, the Pawana Day. I'd heard that many times from monks. Because I was a monk, you'd have to actually you have to stay in your monastery until after that night. So it was only the monks who were actually spending the rains retreat in that monastery, or visitors, lay people, could see it. I heard many, many times about the Naga fireballs just in that Mekong River. I remember once being in Thailand and saw it in the in-flight magazine of Thai Airways. They had pictures of it there. It was the first time that they'd actually managed to get pictures of the fireballs. A couple of years ago, because of, you know, it's this supernatural thing, the Thai television went up there to try and find out, you know, is it real or is it just superstition or what is it? And they took all the photographs of them. They came out perfectly on TV. Only one night of the year, on the full moon night, doesn't happen any other days, as predicted. And they got all these experts to try and figure out, you know, what it was. They discounted like methane from the very bottom of the river floating to the surface and exploding. Because it only happened on one night of the year. If it was a natural phenomenon, there's no reason why it's only one night and not other nights. And so they decided it must be on the other side of the river, the Laotian side. They thought it was soldiers firing up flares. But the next time, they had the cameras on both sides of the river, and they discounted that. It's real Niagara fireballs every year on October. Fascinating. Yeah?
Arjun, was that photograph taken in during the Vietnam War in the Mekong?
Oh, yeah.
About these American soldiers,
yeah.
37 of them holding this.
That's that big Navi.
Was that already a Naga?
Yeah, because for those of you, I think I put that. Yeah, that's actually very close by. That's actually, I put that photograph, I think, in Nolomara. Is it still there? On the wall of the community hall? I think it's still there.
Yeah, I think,
yeah. Yeah, we still got it there. But yeah, this is a photograph which somebody gave me many years ago. But during the Vietnam War, there was a group of US soldiers who would patrol the Mekong River. The base was just outside of Vientiane. This was obviously before the communists took over. And they patrolled the river. They had a sonar. And one day when they were patrolling the river, they got this huge object on their sonar underneath the river. They thought it was some communist submarine. No communist submarines in that area, but that's what they thought. So being US soldiers, they thought, let's bomb it. So they put in all these depth charges and just blew all these dead fish up from the Mekong. And with these dead fish came this huge, you could call it like a big eel. But it had the face, or the head, which just looks exactly like the Chinese dragons. Those dragons you see on the walls of Chinese temples, that's exactly what it looks like. In fact, the only difference from the dragons you see in mythology is that this didn't have any legs. Other than that, it was like a perfect example of what you see on the temple walls. And it was, I don't know how many, I think it was about 7-8 meters long, was it? Or something? Sorry?
It was about 20 feet, 25
feet. Yeah, very, very long. And when I showed people that, they said, oh, it's just digital technology, it's a fake. But I got someone to check it out, and it still actually took it back to somewhere outside, I think Detroit was the main barracks there. They got it in the museum there, in the military museum. They put it in there. And according to the legend, I haven't checked this out because this is a legend which was going around. Every one of those soldiers died prematurely. That was a legend going around. You don't mess around with knives. And somebody actually checked it on the internet, and there was some Latin name for this, but it's only supposed to be found very, very rarely in deep oceans. And they have only found 4, 5, or 6 of them ever. And they got some Latin name, but not in rivers.
Are Nagas kind beings?
Nagas, yeah, Nagas are kind beings. If you mess around, they're not. But, you know, if they're pretty kind to you, because very many of them were Buddhist. So they can protect. They're supposed to be protecting and being rain and stuff. So yeah, they're very protective.
And are they Nyaya?
Sorry?
Are they Nyaya?
Like the lower Deva groups, you'd just call them. Because they're very strange, they seem to straddle the animal realm and the Deva realm. So no one actually really knows exactly where they belong.
What one of them
is associated with Thailand? No, there's a place called Nagalands. Remember the Welsh dragons? Dragons all over the world, the Chinese dragons. So it's part of the waggle in the Aboriginal culture. The dragons and rainbow serpents are all over the place. They're multicultural. Yeah?
If they're fairly powerful and they have a big temperament, why would you make it warm human shape? Why would you ban them from being monks?
I think just because if people saw big snakes, sort of, so if I was a Naga and sort of, I've come nodded off as a big snake, it'd be all right. I should have put a bit bad of anyway. See, I don't. Members of my household practice different religions. Christianity and Buddhism sometimes inevitably discussions discussions or debates on these religions and practice arose, which did not always end amicably because of different views held. What is your wise counsel for these people to live peacefully and harmoniously with one another, besides not to discuss religion at all with one another, even though basically there is no ill will against one another's religion? I am impressed by you in being able to get this Catholic retreat centre to hold a Buddhist meditation retreat. Thanks. Okay, I mean, if religions can't work together in peace and harmony, they don't really deserve to be called spiritual. Isn't that supposed to be what religions are supposed to do, to love your neighbour as yourself? Well, it's my neighbour. He's a Buddhist, he's a Christian, he's a Muslim or an atheist. Aren't you supposed to love them? In Buddhism, to love people unconditionally, may all beings be happy and well. Not just Buddhists, but may all beings be happy and well. And so that you can find a common ground with most people, if it's just like love and harmony and friendship. But if you focus on the differences which you have, then you have the argument. If you focus on what you have in common, what you agree on, then you have harmony. The trouble is that, and what most people do, they're not got you. Something's boring on there, it's not a nugget. If you learn how to actually to live in harmony, which is like focusing what you have in common, which is a lot, then there's no problem at all. You can be great friends. And it's not just this that, what is it, when are the new Norse monks coming? That's, is it next week? Thursday, is it? Or Friday? No, it's the 7th. It's the 7th they come. 7th of November, where every year we have a visit from the Benedictine Catholic monks who live up in New Norcia. And they're coming in on the 7th of November for the afternoon. So? 7th of December, yeah. 7th of December in the afternoon. It's when you live in the present moment. Who cares? November. Some of them are outside. About a week's time, they're coming to visit our monastery. Once a year we go and visit them. We spend this afternoon together. They're Catholics. We are Buddhists. And it's incredible. If you came and watched us, we're really good friends. Now, every when it's my birthday, I get a fax from them. Happy birthday. God bless you. They say. when it's their birthday, it's, you know, that may you be happy and well. And give the Buddhist blessing to their abbot. And it's amazing how, if you came and saw us, it's some years ago that we told one of the Thai ladies, her husband works for the Sunday Times, is a photographer. We told him about this. He thought it's a great story. So he came with his camera and he came with a reporter. And as soon as the Benedictine monks arrived, came in their white robes and we had our brown robes, he was clicking away. And straight away, he said, now how are you going, sort of, you know, Chris, Father Chris, or Brother Chris, how are you going, Abbot Placid? And we were just chatting to each other, and then this reporter just turned around and said, I can't believe this. You guys are friends. I said, what do you expect? They're Catholics, you're Buddhists. You're not even arguing. And she was very, very impressed. I mean, it was unbelievable for her. Just actually, not just that we were being tolerating each other, but how we were really getting on as really close friends. Because what we had in common, we were monks. And that, what we had in common, monks together, meant an awful lot. Even though you're different religions, that's what separated us, but monks actually brought us together. And you don't have to invite to try and get monks to come out when they come. The monks want to come out, because they're your friends. And it's marvellous actually to have that when you have friends of other religions. And of course that other friend, you know, John Shepherd, he's the dean of the local cathedral here. He invited me to give a sermon on the Sunday. Well, how many of you were there for that? Okay, yeah, it's great, isn't it? And he told me, and I've got no reason to doubt him, that's the first time in 2,000 years of Christianity that a non-Christian has given a sermon in the church on Sunday. I'm very proud of that, team. I don't mind sort of boasting about that one. Even though you've got death threats for trying to do that. And we were great friends. It was a very wonderful time to actually see a Christian and a Buddhist together. as really good friends.
I find that Catholic is more amicable with the police.
The what? The
Catholic.
Catholic, and the Anglicans are as well.
Yeah.
The problem comes with the fundamentalists, you know, the sort of this.
The Americans and
England. Yeah, they're anti-everything. They're even anti-other-Christians. So, for those, you have to teach them life. So you may be anti to me, but I'm not going to be anti to you. If you hurt me, I'm going to turn the other cheek. Now, we're supposed to do that. So whatever's happening is that, you know, you actually, because of your actions, because of your words, they may not be friends to you, but you can always be friends to them. So if that's what's happening in your house, instead of arguing about what you have in different, separating you, argue about what you have in common. And that's a way to friendship. Next question. May I have some in the house with that one? Next question. What's the rationale behind that nuns have more rules than monks? It seems more difficult being a nun than a monk. If it was that nuns had less rules than being a monk, they say that's unfair. Why do monks have more rules than nuns? We demand more rules, but you've got too many rules. We demand less rules. We demand the same. So the point is that that's the way the Buddha did it. So, I don't know, rationale behind the nuns, it just, that's the way it happened. But because you've got more rules, does that make you more senior? Because that's actually what you usually have. You get 5 precepts, you get 8 precepts, and you're getting higher in your spirituality. And so 10 precepts, that's called a novice. You get 227 precepts, that's a bhikkhu. And then you've got, 311 rules, you're a bhikkhuni. The bhikkhunis, they've got more rules. Shouldn't that be better? It's only numbers. Who cares about numbers? I don't know, basically. Next question. Here we go. Anyone want to say anything about that? No, good. Dear Ajahn, please explain about emotions in the mind, feelings in the 5 senses, and how they're associated with the Brahma Viharas. There are negative emotions and positive emotions. It's not just all emotions have to be given away. You keep the positive ones, you let go of the negative ones. So the negative ones are like greed, hatred, fault-finding, jealousy, selfishness. Those are all like negative emotions, fear and doubt. So we abandon those, but we keep the positive emotions like inspiration, like kindness, like compassion, sympathetic joy. One of the great emotions which we keep also is peace. Peace is an emotion. So those are the emotions. And the positive ones is what we keep, what we develop. Anyone who's got even close to a jhana just know how hugely emotional that is. Powerful energy flowing through your body, which makes you cry afterwards. It's emotional state, deeply emotional. The most powerful emotions you can have is the jhanas. That's why it's scary sometimes, the power of them. But those are good ones, ones to develop. So the emotions are good, are great. And the 5 senses, emotions connected with the 5 senses are usually sort of negative. It's emotions associated with the mind. I've talked about inspiration, talked about sort of generosity or kindness. Those are all mind states. Tiredness is a negative emotion. Let's get on with this. Next question. Could you please tell us the expected completion date of the meditation retreat in Serpentine? Thank you. You mean this one here or meditation retreat in Serpentine? Unless you mean the Range Retreat. The Range Retreat always finishes on the full moon day of October, the same day that in the Mekong River the Nagas struck the 5 balls. That's when our 3-month retreat finishes. Yeah? The completion date of the meditation retreat center in Serpentine. Aha! We're getting plans to build a retreat center in Serpentine. So when you have this is 5-star. We're not going to have any crucifixes on the wall. And it's going to be absolutely perfect. And the plumbing is going to work, so whenever you're downstairs and someone watches the project, you don't hear anything. That's going to be a must. And the rooms upstairs are going to be nice and cool. So whatever it's going to be. So we're doing going to build a retreat centre over there. But anyway, so that we just the other day when I was in there, a couple of days ago, it was actually two architects because we're supposed to be drawing some plans so we can get a brochure together. So they just showed me the rough plans so we can get the brochure together. Actually, maybe tomorrow I might leave them in here if anyone wants to have a look at them. So it'll be completed when we get the money. Don't get any money, doesn't get completed. So who cares? And with Pale Brook fundraising. So whenever the funds come, they come. When they don't come, they don't come. So we're going to start raising funds soon. But our own retreat centre, state of the art. That's coming soon. I don't know when it's going to be finished, whenever things happen. Maybe it's because of past karma. There are times when some new persons I get to know and straight away I feel dislike for their looks. Oh, this is not right. Should I approach it by avoiding the person or getting closer to the person and dissolve the feelings somehow? Okay. Maybe every now and again it might be bad karma. It's not because of their looks. Sometimes it's because they may have been enemies before and you feel really unpleasant. It's not because of their looks. It's just like fault-finding mind. So it doesn't matter what they look like. You just know who they are. So if you always get upset what people look like, just wear dark glasses. Really dark glasses. Black glasses. You don't see them. So yeah. So I think that's the fault finding mind. Don't worry about what people look like. Now, Dan, if one goes to sleep and closes one's eyes, should the nimitta keep appearing, what should one do? Okay. Actually, it's sometimes that if the nimittas appear during your sleep, they wake you up. So it's great when you get nimitta coming up in your sleep. A couple of times that's happened to me. Remember once, I remember telling Ajahn Jnana about this. Ajahn Jnana, my second monk, many of you know him. I had this dream. It was just an emotion, wasn't it? Just doing a retreat. We were passing almost like shrines of these great monks, in our tradition. And he went on ahead, and I was looking and really sort of feeling just so inspired at this shrine for Ajahn Tep. There's a little picture of him there, and as soon as I got inspired, the whole thing just exploded in this powerful light. Oh, it's so bliss. I've got this amazing nimitta in the dream. And of course, as soon as that comes, you wake up. You can't sort of hold that to be of energy in sleep space. You wake up, start meditating, have a great time. But even in sleep, you can get nimittas sometimes. But if the nimitta appears, the real nimittas, you wake up. My goodness, it's just too powerful. Sometimes you get into deep meditation, get some really nice dreams. Remember once having this psychic battle with the Hindu in the dreams. It's great fun to hear. Just like in the movies, they have all these battles with, what is it, Spider-Man, psychic?
Star
Wars. Are they psychic battles? I thought it was something else. I saw a picture in the newspaper or something. Oh, is it that crouching tiger, sleeping lion or something? Hind dragon, yeah. Okay, yeah. So I was doing that, just flying around this room. I went to see him into his temple. Flying around the room and zapping each other. I don't know if it's a five. It's in my dream, I won. It's my dream. I've got a right to it in my dream. Okay. Lady Mother Teresa was an enlightened person. I'm sure her compassion and loving kindness shown in the poor and suffering in Calcutta would have shown those people what dukkha was. Although the impermanence of no self, they probably didn't have to meditate as such, as life is itself may have shown in these three truths with metta. Yeah, you don't know. The only way you can know if someone's in line is actually to live with them. Because sometimes that, you know, what they do in public, and put on a show, it's a little bit for a long time to find out if a person's in line. They can be compassionate. But sometimes it's like, I've been told this with nurses. They're so compassionate to their patients. When they go in the nurse's room, they're just really bitchy at each other. They're really cruel. Many people said that. I mean, this is, people in Perth will know this. There's a funeral company called Marina Perslow. When they first started, I did a funeral. They were actually sharing the premises with the men, the Perslows. I think it was Arthur Perslow, I think it was. And so they were sharing a funeral parlour with them. And so I was doing a funeral for a Buddhist who died. And after the funeral service in the funeral parlour was finished, we were going to go to the crematorium. So all the family got out, going in their cars. I actually went with the coffin into the hearse. So I went round the back as they, you know, closed up the coffin and put it in the back. And as they was putting the thing in the car, there's one thing in the car they were missing, because the ladies had used it before. And this guy was saying, oh, these ladies, you know, they're very popular because people think they're compassionate. They're compassionate to the clients, but they're not compassionate to us, he said. And I think this actually happens sometimes as a compensation of compassion. If you really have to be compassionate in your job, and sometimes when you're just with your friends, you know, you compensate and you get quite mean. People tell me that with nurses. Are there any nurses here? Is that the case sometimes? Not with you, because you're so compassionate.
Well, I'm not a nurse, but I think it's the same everywhere. People are people.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, so sometimes that happens. So the only time, if you're in some sort of serving capacity, like, you know, assist Mother Teresa or a monk or anybody, you can be very kind and compassionate sort of when you're sitting on the front seat. And it's actually that how you are in all manner of life, especially when things start to go wrong, that's when you're tested out. It's one of those old poems. It's easy enough to be happy when life goes along like a song. But the one worthwhile is the one who can smile when everything goes all wrong. Very nice poem, that. So if you can, when everything goes all wrong, and your whole life's sort of a mess, you can be peaceful then and kind then, and that's the sign of an enlightened person. Everything's going well, and people are laughing at your jokes. It's easy to be compassionate. When you don't laugh and say, that's a most terrible talk, this is the worst retreat I've ever been on. I want my money back. You call yourself a monk. So, would they do that? You think, oh, okay, so that. Okay, do that, Jan. The last question. In the Metta Sutta, do not hold on to fixed views. What are the fixed views? Really, Metta. Okay. I know somebody asked me that question the other night, and it was quite late, so I didn't really sort of give it the full answer. That's the old translation we had before, not holding on to fixed views. It's quite a nice translation, unfortunately not really accurate. So because we didn't hold on to that fixed view of the translation there, we've changed it to not hold on to false views, which is actually more close, because saying it's a fixed view is a false view. So we fix the view into making a false view, because the view of what it meant a long time ago wasn't fixed, so we changed it. If you understand what I mean. Because the point is, everybody has a view. Even if I have no views, that's another view. You can't get away, because your view is just the way you look at life. Everyone has to have a view. If you've got a mind, you've got a view. The way you look at life. And to say, I've got no views at all, that's just another view. The Buddha actually called that ill-wiggling. Because there was one guy and says, if you ask me if it was so, I wouldn't say it's so, nor would I say it's not so, nor would I say it's otherwise. He went on like this, so you could never pin this guy down. It's called like an eel rigger, because you can actually never get hold of them. And so that's like, I've got no views. That's a view. Oh, no. Even that view, I don't hold. Sometimes I have a view, sometimes I have no views. That's my view. And it's just like eel-wiggling. Everybody's got a view, a way we look at life. So the point is here that there are views which are in accord with Dhamma. And there are views which actually bend the truth, and they're not really Dhamma. It's the ones which bend the truth the Buddha asks you to let go of. Views, you know, which come from the sense of self, me and my, what I want. Views which come from ill will. You know, that person's a pig. That person is so lazy. Those sorts of views. Sometimes we have those views. We have views of our husband, our wife, our kids, our monk, or whatever. So views which are part of those defilements are called wrong views. So that's why I say, by not holding on to wrong views. But you can say fixed views if you like. Whichever one you want. It's not fixed. And that is the last question. Amazing. All the questions are finished. So now you know all the answers. So you never have to ask a question ever again in your life. Isn't that so? Or will tomorrow there'll be another question? So when will there be an end of all these questions? When the mind becomes still and never makes another question. Remember the fundamental question, why? And now you know the answer.
Because
there is nothing. When there's nothing, there's no more questions. When there's no more questions, there's no more answers. There's no more answers, there's nothing left. And then you can sleep peacefully without wondering, what should I do in the morning? What should I do now? No questions. What you should be doing is what you are doing. Because here it is. So, ending of all the doings. So remember, now the questions are all finished. This is the last night. Usually the last night on the retreat is sometimes the most powerful. Think of all the energy, all the good karma you've been building up over these days. It's just like the powers are all there coming together. In one life's Christianity, you don't have to leave yet. I just need to get into it. In one last crescendo of peace and meditation power. It's getting up there, you can feel the energies arising. All of that goodness you've done over the last 8 days. And this is all building up. This is the last night. This could be it. So, if you want to make the most of things, don't worry about sleeping. You can sleep on the plane back to Singapore. You can sleep on the way to LA. If you're not going overseas, you're not going to LA, you can sleep as much as you like in your coffin when you're dead. But now, you have life, you have Dhamma. Strike while the iron is hot. Now is the time for practice. Be diligent, otherwise you will regret it. But don't be too diligent, otherwise you'll regret it even more. So please enjoy yourself, and have a nice meditate. If you're really, really tired, you can go to bed, but get up early. Last night, yeah? Okay. So I'll just to let people know what's happening tomorrow, because tomorrow, if you're still alive, but I will die, that's for sure, you know. Tomorrow what happens is we have the normal morning session, the 7 o'clock breakfast, the 8 o'clock talk. There'll be no interviews tomorrow, except if you're enlightened, you can have a special interview to come and tell me. So if someone says, can I have an interview, I say, ah, someone's enlightened, come on, listen. So then, 11 o'clock we have the lunch. And I think after the lunch we do the clean up, I think, is that right? Well anyway, but back by 2 o'clock, because at 2 o'clock we'll give the parting talk. So I'll give it a little Dhamma talk, that was number one, extra one at 2 o'clock. And then we have a loving kindness meditation. And that'll be followed by, just at the very end, a sharing of merits and then a blessing. To finish at 3? Is that what the, or 4? 5? 2?
Three thirty.
Okay, 3:30, yeah. Okay, so we'll come back at 2 anyway. Yeah?
Ask Ajahn, could we come back at 1 o'clock?
Yeah, sure, whatever time you want to come back, that's it. But make sure you're all back by 2, because we'll come and have a talk there. Is that okay?
The question I have is, I don't know if I'm going to have any place, but I just didn't pick up a gear and move
there. Okay.
And that's also the side, you know, your experience standard for it, and so people need to go again and have it afterwards.
Okay. So that means that whatever happens, come back by at least 2 o'clock. If you're sitting outside or walking outside, come together and give the last words of advice.
Yes.
Silence. Pull your hands up if you want to keep noble silence until 1 minute to 3:30. Right. Hands up if you don't want to keep, if you want. Because sometimes we say that just after lunch you can start talking. Who wants to start talking after lunch? Okay. So I think. So?
It doesn't matter
either way. Yeah.
I'll try to be silent.
Okay. You can write notes. Yeah, you can write notes. Just try to keep it silent a lifetime and afterwards, I think. Just do the very best. So you can keep it right to the very end. And this moment, so you can say hello to each other. And who are you anyway? The person I've been sitting next to for the last 9 days. What's your name? We did that at the very end. Yeah?
When will Rod be talking about the availability of these talks on CD, other than the fact that we know that they somehow will be?
Those talks will always be available on the CD in your heart. They'll be memorable, never to be forgotten, I hope. Next week they'll be available. So if you're going overseas, you can just give him your address or something and go and email them to you, or fax them, or to your send them or something, whatever they do with these things. Okay, any other questions? Yeah?
Are we going to do the experiment, like you said? Are they sharing with the
loving kindness? Oh, yeah, we'll do that tomorrow. Okay. Do the loving kindness.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's when actually I ask you to spread loving kindness to someone close to you. Look at the time when you go back and see them. Say, what were you doing at that time? I love doing little tricks and experiments like that just to see if it really works. And it does. Okay. No more questions then. So the night is young. The power is around you. May that power be with you. That's what they used to say, was in Star Wars or something. May the power be, no, the force. May the force of the Dharma be with you.